All right, everybody, this is Chase March, and I have an author on the phone right now, Rick Neese. How's it going, Rick?
It's going well, Chase. What an honor to be able to talk to you.
Yeah, well, I first heard about your book. Someone actually approached me, management, I think, at the publisher, and it seemed like a really cool book. It seemed like it was right up my alley. It's called The Band Plays On, Going Home for a Music Man's Encore. And you wrote it basically about your father, who's a bandmaster, a band director of a marching band, and people were coming back to pay tribute to him upon his retirement?
Exactly. My dad was a band director, and in fact, he was the whole music show in this small school in a very small town in Ohio, a town of 900. We had about 150 in the high school, and my dad taught everything, first grade through 12th grade that had to do with music. He taught chorus, he taught concert band, marching band, music appreciation courses. And at one point in this high school of 150 people, there were 80 people in the band and 100 people in chorus. So a much beloved individual, and the story arc of the book is, it really is, it starts out in the present that got a call from one of my classmates. I'd not been back to that hometown for some time. They were trying to pull together a band alumni of 16 years of classes that my dad had taught, and to have a parade through the town, have a concert downtown, and then also play at halftime of a football game and play the Star Spangled Banner along with the current band. So that was an exciting project to get us all back together and to honor my father.
It's a really great thing to do too, because I think too often we don't pay tribute to, you know, real inspiring people until they're dead, you know, and that kind of thing would come afterwards. Oh, he was such a great conductor and we loved him, but it's really nice to be able to actually see this much love and support and a whole event being going and thrown while he's still alive and able to appreciate it.
Well, and it was amazing how many people came back and the love that they still had for my dad. And I think the idea, there's still appreciation for music. My dad was never one who was an elitist with music, be it chorus or instrumental. Come participate was his whole plan. And although we had very good choruses and very good bands, as I say, it wasn't an elitist group. And I think there were a number of people who were not only influenced by him as an individual, and as a teacher, and as a teacher of music, but just by his ethics and his values. A lot of the book as well is not particularly about the music, but it's about my dad primarily. And also, I think with me, the influence that a small town has on a young, influential boy being raised in a small town.
Yeah, well, that kind of leads me into the one criticism I do have of the book. Because I really wanted to experience more of your dad and the music and the coming together. But it's kind of written more like a memoir of your days of growing up in this small town. It's kind of where most of the bulk of the book takes place.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair criticism. You always hate to disappoint a reader who thinks they're going to be seeing something else. Try to set it up in terms of being, it's not a biography. And in fact, it's a term that I thought I created, but I didn't. And that's an automythography, which would be like a memoir or an autobiography. And I think about, probably half to 60% of the book deals directly with my dad. And probably 35 or 40% deals with music itself. And of course, in the book culminates with the actual event itself. But I understand that, that you think it should have been more about him and more about the music. That's fair.
I hate to be so critical of it, but once everyone got into town, that's where I was like, oh yeah, this is where it should start. But that was like fairly late in the book. And I thought it would have been neat to maybe not make it so auto-mythography, as you called it, but maybe it do a little bit more, you know, interviews and research with some of the other band members there, past and present, and tell more of a cohesive story of what your dad meant to the town and to all these young kids playing music and marching together.
I hear you, and that's a different book, and this is the second book in a series, so there'll be a third book, and they all kind of start in the present, go into the past, and then end up back in the present. And that certainly would be another book, and I think it would probably be a worthwhile book as well. But the story arc is really is music and my dad. But it all isn't about my music or my dad or his influence specifically on his students.
Yeah. Well, it's the musician in me because, I mean, we're both educators. And I love music and I love being able to share that passion with my students. But I teach primary school, so I'll do it through choir and through rap music sometimes and things like that to really share that passion. And it's amazing how much the kids really respond to music and how important it is. And I think we really need to pay focus to that right there, how important the arts are in education these days.
I can't argue with you. I know here in the States, where we continue to face some real financial issues within our public school systems, the first thing to go has to do with anything with the fine arts, with art, with music, with dance, and theater. And I do think that's tragic. And part of what I was trying to capture is how important music was to us as we were growing up. But that, the story arc, that was kind of the catch in the book to get me back to that hometown and talk about other things within that hometown as well. I know what you're saying, but that would be a different book. But I can certainly hear your passion and your love for music and getting that love across to students and an appreciation, I think, of all kinds of music.
For sure. And like you said, the budget isn't there all the times for the schools. So it's really nice to see that this book and sales from the book are actually going to support Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation.
Well, I really appreciate you mentioning that. Yes, for $1 for every book sold goes to Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation. That was founded by Henry Mancini's daughter, and anybody who knows much about music certainly knows the name Henry Mancini. And Felice Mancini has a foundation for schools to apply for grants who might not have enough money to buy instruments or other things that have to do with music. And it's a terrifically worthy foundation. And if nothing more, if people purchase the book knowing that a dollar is going toward that foundation. And I also have a Facebook page right now where people go to that Facebook page, and if they like the Facebook page, I will donate for everyone who likes that Facebook page. I'll donate another dollar to the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation. Terrifically worthy, as you all know.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I played in bands starting in middle school, grade 7, all the way through high school. And then I was also in a marching band in the Army, the Royal Hamilton Light Infantry, but never once did I own my own instrument. I mean, it was always the schools or it was the Army. And at least if we can get kids access to the instruments, even if they don't own them, like I still had a great time and I wouldn't have traded that for the world playing in any of those bands.
And what did you play, Chase?
I played the French horn.
Oh, I'm envious. Oh, I love the French horn. You had to have a really good embouchure because a lot of those tones really came from the pressure that you were putting on, you know, if people understand on a mouthpiece, that's a small mouthpiece, but I love the sound of a French horn.
I love it too, but you started out playing trumpet, and trumpet and French horn are very similar,
right,
at least in the fingering positions.
Yes, and because I started on the trumpet, I read treble clef, not bass clef. Did you read treble clef? Was that for the French horn as well? Was treble clef or was it bass clef?
No, it's treble clef. I read both. I read both at the same time.
Oh, do you really?
Because I also play accordion. So when you play accordion, you're playing treble and bass at the same time. So.
Oh, how cool was that? How'd you get on the accordion?
My parents got me into it when I was a kid. So I played it before I actually had music instruction in school. So I was playing it, I think, when I was about 7. And I played it till I was about 14. And it was amazing because my music teacher at the time also taught us theory. So by the time I was in high school and we were learning the theory, I already knew it all. I didn't learn a single thing theory-wise in high school because I'd already learned it from my accordion.
You already knew it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's... Well, and then I went from trumpet to baritone. So... Most, you know, you go from trumpet where you're playing a lot of melodies to baritone where it's lower brass and playing a lot of counter melodies. But I really like the baritone. And in many ways, the French horn, the baritone, you had a lot of melodies that you played as well with the French horn, but you also had some good counter melodies with it as well.
Definitely. I like there's one passage in the book because you have a baritone and in preparation for the alumni band, you had it repaired. And the quote says, "I choked up when I opened the case and saw my reconditioned baritone looking up at me. She was new when Dad entrusted her to me as a kid, and now she looked new again."
Yeah, well read. And I get emotional even when I hear that and read about that, because she'd been so abused. And just to hold that baritone again, and I now own it. I mean, it's my baritone. And it had been so damaged that the music teacher back at my home school just did not feel that they had the funds to repair it. So they literally gave it to me. And it cost a ton of money to have it fixed. But I still find myself playing it. My embouchure has weakened drastically over the years, and I'm amazed at how quickly my lip gets tired. But just having that baritone with me helps me relive a whole lot of those days of being in the marching band and the concert band, and just how important that was to me. So, you know, you were talking earlier about how not only do many schools not able to have instruments, but certainly most, you know, students don't own their instruments. Just what a thrill it is to have that instrument still with you, and the instrument that I played as a kid.
For sure. But your dad switched you to baritone. I guess he just told you, well, you have to switch because he didn't have enough baritones in the band at the time, eh?
That's right. And I was in the fifth grade at that time, and ended up then being in the marching band when I was in the sixth grade. And it was kind of funny when I think back on it. And, you know, the big kids accepted me pretty well. But yeah, he didn't have any baritones and needed a baritone. And fortunately, over the years, as I mentioned in the book, that my hat was too big and the baritone was almost as big as I was. But over the years, I grew into my hat and into my baritone as well.
Very cool. Yeah, and your dad's name
is Lewis. He's still alive. My dad will be 89 in this coming September. And what my dad does now is he has memorized 7 different piano programs of 34 numbers each in each piano program of music from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And since my mother has passed away, my dad now, his new mission is to play at nursing homes and retirement centers, and to go in and play the music that he was raised on and the music that the people of his generation love to hear. So here's this man going on 89, he's memorized 7 different programs of 34 songs within each program.
Wow, that's really cool. He sounds like an amazing man. I mean, I know he was in the military, and he was he was an educator, and he painted houses in the summer, and he directed the church choir, and he even started a bowling alley because you didn't have one in your small town.
No, we didn't, and that was so it's called the Duck Inn. And yeah, Dad decided that my dad never liked any idle time, and decided that the town needed a bowling alley, and ran that for probably 5 or 6 years. That was a good experience too. We didn't have automatic pin setters. We teenagers would jump down in the pits and set the pins and get up out of the way after the person had bowled. That was a great experience. My dad continues to be such an amazing role model for me. Part of the theme too, and Chase, you probably picked this up, is a theme of echoes. And the introduction talks about on a Memorial Day, a specific Memorial Day, when the band marched to our hometown cemetery. And we always ended every concert with John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever. But then there was a point at the end of the ceremony when I would leave the rank of the bands and go over the single hill in the cemetery. And my dad would play taps in front of the veterans who were kind of underneath a canopy and a tent. And at that time, there were still World War I veterans who were alive. And over the hill, I would play the echo. I can remember as a little kid how nervous I was, and I would just pace little boy circles as my dad was playing. And my dad always played perfectly. And the title of that introduction chapter is called Echoes Can Make No Mistakes. And that idea that I'm his echo and I can't make any mistakes. And I think in many ways my whole life I have been my father's echo. And not that I can't make mistakes, but I like being his echo. Because in my, with what I echo then are also remnants of his echoes. And I think, you know, part of the theme of the book as well is generational things and how those echoes are so important that we continue to listen to and to sponge up, because then we, in time, become the echoes for the generation following us.
Yeah, that's really touching. But at the same time, did you ever feel like you were, you know, trapped in a shadow of this great man? It would be hard for you to live up to.
You know, I'm going to tell something that I don't think I've told many other people before, so you get a scoop on it. Yeah, two things to answer your question. Number one, I fought going into education because I knew I could never be as good a teacher as my dad was. And I really just fought it. And it wasn't until the end of my sophomore year in college that I decided that I wanted to teach. But the thing that I haven't told many people is I started college as a music major. And I went to Ohio State University, tried out for the marching band there. And I don't know if they have fame in Canada or not, but the Ohio State Marching Band is a pretty spectacular marching band. I was an alternate and really ended up being primarily in what was called the Ohio State Gray Band. They had a Scarlet Band, they had a Gray Concert Band. The Scarlet Band was primarily people who were music majors and instrumental music majors and just really tough to compete with. And I just wasn't as good as I thought I was, but ended up in the Gray Band. I realized then I had the passion for music that you have, but I didn't think that I had that passion that I needed to teach it. So then I ended up being an English major and teaching English. So my dad was so revered and was so respected that there was a shadow there. And I don't mean it to sound negative at all. It was not negative, but decided that I could be a good teacher and really learn from my dad. And if there was one lesson that I learned from my dad about teaching, and to me it's the simplest lesson. You've been an educator for 9 years. You'll know exactly what I'm saying because there are some people, I think, who forget this lesson, and that is that students always come first. Students are the purpose for schools and education. And Chase, I'm amazed sometimes at how many people, including teachers, forget that.
Well, I understand that too, but I also understand, like right now in Ontario, there's kind of a battle against teachers, and the government's trying to take away a lot of the gains that we've had and things like that. And so I totally agree with you, but at the same time, I think, you know, teachers overall, especially elementary school teachers, are kind of looked down on sometimes, like we're not important. And I think we really need to give our teachers more and put them, you know, we need to give them the tools to do the job and make sure that we can put them first. So in turn, we can put students first. I know that sounds really complicated, but
this is what amazes me. You know, now I'm a president of a university, a small university in Arkansas. Faculty members have a great job, but I think we oftentimes forget, and it's not a hierarchy. And what you just said is true. It isn't vertical, where the kindergarten teacher's at the bottom and a full tenured full professor is at the top. It's not vertical, it's horizontal. We all play our part on a student's education on a horizontal plane. Can you visualize what I'm saying? And I hope you know your listeners can as well, that every one of those is important as we build. But if you don't have the resources and build at the second grade or the third grade, I don't care if it's music or reading or writing, it becomes difficult then as students progress. And I'm also amazed at how teaching is daggone hard work. You're tired by the end of a day. And then you go home and you prepare for the next day and you prepare lesson plans and you grade papers. And I'm not complaining about it. I'm not making excuses about it. But I don't think people realize how difficult it is to be a teacher. Because I'm assuming that in Canada it's very similar to in the United States. And part of what I want in this series of books, and I'm going to mention too that the first book is called Side Yard Superhero, and that also takes place in this small town. But is to try to get people to understand how important our education is, that it follows us. But the teachers do amazing work, and the teachers need to be rewarded on all kinds of levels. And one of the things that I hope comes through with my books is that when I was a kid, being raised in a small town in Ohio, I had really four support systems that were watching out for me all the time. I had my family, I had my school, I had my church, and I had my small town community that in a sense was like a second set of parents or a great aunt and uncle or an older brother. Unfortunately, there are some kids today who don't have any of those. And it becomes all the more important for us as educators to try to provide all those things for students. And I'm guessing that's what helps wear you out as well, as students come in with such a variety of needs, and the only place sometimes they can get that need is in your classroom.
Yeah, and that's what's nice about this series of books, because it focuses on small town life, and that really is something, you know, I mean, it's cliche, it takes a village to raise a child, but I think we do need strong communities of like-minded individuals, and whether it's a small town, or it's a school, or it's an extracurricular activity, or whether it's Boy Scouts or Girl Guides, the youth really need things like that, and we need to be able to create a culture where they can feel safe within our own classrooms and within our bigger circles of what we do extracurricular as well.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And you see, I mean, you've got some elementary kids who probably have experienced some things that you and I never did until high school or maybe even now. I mean, in terms of some family situations or home situations or need situations, it's a different time. And one of the things I've tried to do is to capture that, not only for people like me who lived through it, but for people who didn't know a time like that existed. It's just so important. And again, I know you and I try not to talk in cliches, but the education of our kids on all different aspects is so important. And if we miss that opportunity, it can never be made up again.
Yeah, I agree. I also like how you have some stories in here that, you know, a lot of people couldn't relate to, but we can think back of how that might have been. Like, I would have no idea what a bowling alley looks like without an automatic pin setter. And having to stand back there and, you know, pins flying up at you and people getting hit with pins doing that kind of a part-time job. And, like, you know, the risk involved in that and what kids are doing these days. And then you also have a nice scene about the movie theater. And
yes,
I can quote out of the book here. We're talking to Rick D. Neese. He wrote The Band Plays On. This is a quote from page 72. It says, "Today, a small box of movie popcorn costs more than it used to cost to take a date to the Roxy and buy the whole refreshment work."
Yeah, and there's one point, I think I'm at the variety store that we had downtown, and 5 years old, and I didn't realize I had stolen this candy bar, but somehow I had it and hadn't paid for it, so that certainly would be a definition of stealing. But those were 5-cent candy bars that were much bigger than the bars that cost at least $1 now. And, you know, I don't mean to sound like an old fogey, but that was a time, and it was a time of innocence and of nostalgia. And one of the things I mentioned is these are very carefully pocketed memories. One thing in book one, Side Yard Superhero, I had a paper route. From age 9 until I went to college, I had that paper route. And I was speaking to a college class last February, and my wife was with me, and I said I was a paper boy. And what Cherie seldom does, she interrupted me and she said, "Rick, you need to explain to them what a paper boy is, that it's not a boy made out of paper." And I hadn't thought about that, that most of them wouldn't have a concept of somebody riding a bicycle and delivering the newspaper to houses.
Yeah, that, I mean, so it changed, because we had paper boys when I was a kid, but now the papers are delivered by older people, usually because you get them first thing in the morning instead of after school, so a lot of stuff has changed.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of kids who wouldn't want to deliver papers. That was one of my life's best lessons, because if you had a paper out, you had people who depended upon you getting that paper to them, you had responsibility, you had fiscal responsibility because you had to collect so much money because you had to pay the paper for the papers for that week. Plus, it really taught me how to deal with people and how to work with people, some who were difficult, but how you treat customers and how you treat people. And I think that has followed me even into being a university president. The role model I think I am for our students here is I have a strong belief in servant leadership and being a servant leader. And servant leaders mean you're not embarrassed to be seen carrying a chair, or in our workroom here, we have coffee and hot chocolate and tea and about 35 different kinds of tea. But it's anybody can come in and get a cup of coffee for free. Students come in, and it breaks down that pretense for the president's office and students. But the kids see me making a cup of coffee for them. That's a good thing. The idea of being a servant leader is not beneath anybody.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that as well. I find myself keep agreeing with you today, but I think...
Yeah, well, even though the book wasn't quite what you thought it would be, at least you agree with the author.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love the concept behind the book. I mean, maybe it was just I was expecting more of that than the small town story, which I think would appeal to a lot of people, because you're going home for a specific purpose, but as you're doing that, you're remembering your childhood and sharing these stories and celebrating the town of DeGraff quite nicely and honoring your dad in the same time. So it really is a sweet story that I think a lot of people will enjoy. And I don't think you need to be an educator or a musician like we both are to enjoy the book.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I would say, if it's okay, my website is rickneesbooks.com, and people can read more about me or read more about the book. The book is available through Amazon or through any bookstores. And I had a reviewer who, in reviewing both the books, said they're for anybody age 10 to 110. And they're books that grandparents wouldn't be embarrassed to give to grandchildren or grandchildren to grandparents. That the content is something they can share and enjoy. There's an American writer named William Carlos Williams. And Williams wrote poetry as well as writing about writing. He wrote the poem, The Red Wheelbarrow. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow.
I remember that one.
With rainwater beside the white chickens. Now, when you teach that, it's like, oh my gosh, there's nothing there. But William's idea was, you need to write about your own backyard. You need to write about the local before you write about the universal. And his idea was, discover the universal in your local or your own backyard. And I've really bought into that, where right now, what I write about is what I know and what I remember. And I like the idea of automythography. Everything is true, but myths are things that are handed down and handed down. And in some ways, these are stories that I've told over and over the years. And I talk about an automythography being a work of nonfiction that looks reflectively at what I think I remember and how I think I remember it, and that it's an iridescent memory based upon truth and the author's memory. And I try to explain, for me, memories are like soap bubbles, and that's where iridescent fits in. As soap bubbles float away from us, they change shapes and colors, but they're the same soap bubble. And I think our memories over time change shapes and colors, but they're the same memories. It has to happen in your family and in your listeners' families. If you go back to, or if you've, you know, moved away from home and you're married, but you come back and bring your family back to a Thanksgiving, and you have brothers and sisters there, and you talk about a real funny incident or something that happened, each one of you remembers it a little bit differently, but it's the same story. And that's, for me, where automythography really works, because they are my stories. They've been retold and retold, but they're based upon truth. But sometimes memory plays tricks on us, if that makes sense or not. That's why I have trouble sometimes when people write an autobiography, or they quote something specifically as though that's exactly the way it happened. What I try to do within this, I do have quotes and I do have times where there's dialogue, but it's as I remember that dialogue was, knowing that it's based upon my memory.
There's a mini photo album in the back of the book.
Yes.
Entitled Captured Memories. And you can see the high school band from back in the day. And you can see yourself, you know, as a Cub Scout with your dad in his bandmaster's uniform.
And kind of in my dad's shadow there, to go back to what you had said earlier. That's interesting.
It is, isn't it? And then the alumni band. And it's interesting because you all had white T-shirts and it said Louis Alumni Band. And then on the back, it had the year that you graduated.
Exactly. Yeah, I still have my shirt. That's a very valuable thing to me. I also mentioned, and probably something that intrigued you a little bit, my dad was in charge of all-county music, and that was a big deal then. If you got chosen to be a part of all-county music, And Dad, because he was one of the veteran band directors, was able to help select people to come. And one year we had Meredith Wilson, who was our guest conductor for this All County Music. And for people who might not know Meredith Wilson, wrote a number of Broadway musicals, including The Unthinkable Molly Brown and probably his biggest hit, The Music Man. And I can remember, and I mentioned this in the book, sitting there when he was telling us about being raised in this small town in Iowa, but that at one time he played piccolo and flute and he was conducted by John Philip Sousa. Here I was sitting there being conducted by a guy who had been conducted by John Philip Sousa. When he wrote The Music Man, it was really a tribute to his small town in Iowa. And I just thought, what a wonderful thing to be able to write a tribute to a town that had so much influence on you. And in the book, I refer to him as my second favorite music man behind my father.
That's pretty inspirational that your dad was able to get all these famous guest conductors in and really get the kids exposed to like some different ways of conducting, but also seeing how music's important and celebrated in a lot of different areas.
As I said, that's something I think that sense of participation is what people continue to feel, that they had a joy and a love of music and they were able to participate in it and not have a select choir or a select chorus, which is good, but in this small town, to be able to be a part of this thing that was really important for the town, and that was the music.
Very cool. The book is called The Band Plays On, Going Home for a Music Man's Encore, and we've been talking to the author, Rick D. Neese, PhD. It's been very nice talking to you, so right now you need to run down how people can get in touch with you and how they can get a copy of this book.
Yes, if you would go to my website, again, that's rickneesebooks.com, and there are different headers there. One talks about the book, but also how to purchase the book. And if people want to contact me, on the homepage at the top, it says Contact Rick. They can click on that, and then they can write to me. I'd be more than willing if people want me to send them an autographed copy. I would do that as well. But the book is available through Amazon. It will also be on Kindle, but all major bookstores will carry it as well. Might have to go in and tell them, but they can certainly get it pretty quickly. And I would be pleased if anybody would read it, want to react to it. But I tell you what, Chase, I've done a variety of interviews. I don't know that I've had one that I've enjoyed more than this on two levels. Number one, I really appreciate your honesty. That means a lot to me as a writer. And number two, how I know you're continuing to have your passion for music, your passion for education. You are instilling that in your students every day. And to know what a difference you're making with your class, that someday there's going to be students talking about you and say, remember him and remember what a difference he made in our lives. There's nothing more rewarding than that.
Thanks a lot. That's really nice to say.
It's been such a joy to talk to you. And good luck with your writing.
Thanks. Well, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Send my love to your dad.
My dad now lives in the guest house 6 months out of the year beside the president's house, and he comes in every morning into my office at 7:30 for a cup of coffee. I will relay what you said about him and what a delightful time I had talking with you.
Excellent. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Chase. Great talking with you.
You too. Okay. Take care.
Bye.